It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Torn from the fiery pages of the mightiest annals of the West comes the supreme saga in the great tradition of frontier drama.
Francis.
Blazing saddle, he wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far.
What's your name?
Well, my name is Jim, but most people call me Jim.
Well, do your best.
Let's see. Where were we?
Oh, Rock Ridge.
Rock Ridge. I want that land. Clumsy fool.
I'm sorry.
Wait a minute. There might be legal precedent. Of course. Land snatching. Let's see. Land. Land. See snatch.
Hello, handsome. Is that a 10-gallon hat?
Just sign this, sir, right here.
Okay, give us a hand here.
All right, sir.
Work, 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 work.
Okay, folks, let's wipe them out!
The heroic sheriff rallies his citizens in the wildest finish the West has ever seen, or the movies have ever shown.
Ow! Oh, ow! Have you ever seen such cruelty?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I am Paul Spitero, and I am joined, as always, by Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is a pleasure to be here, sir.
And it is a pleasure to have you here, and yippee-ki-yay to you, my friend. maybe later on we'll sing a work song. But we are joined today by Mr. John Schaefer Hames.
I get no kick from champagne.
Hello, Paul.
Hey, John. So now, give you just the slightest background. The first time that, well, first of all, we're disappointed that Maggie's not with us today, but she's a little under the weather and she's not going to be here. Because usually, John and Maggie, as far as this show goes, are joined at the hip. But, you know, this time around, we're going to have to make do without her, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's going to be weird having my thoughts without the smart ones to balance them immediately, but we'll do what we can.
the scales have definitely tipped between the three of us. But anyway, the first time that John and Maggie were on, we talked about Young Frankenstein. And that's, I don't know how many years ago, maybe 5-6 years ago.
It was one of the first shows, somebody else's show that we went on, I think.
And we talked then, when we finished, we said, you know what, we got to do Blazing Saddles. And it took us until today to do it, So I think we're in a position of come hell or high water, we're getting this episode recorded.
Hell yeah.
Because we've waited so long. So just by way of background, this movie came out in 1974 and it was rated R. Which I look at it and it boggles my mind that it was rated R, other than the fact that there's, let's just say, some insensitive moments in it. But that said, I remember being, you know, a young person, 11 years old, and I couldn't see this movie, and I heard people talking about it, and I was like, boy, I really wanted to see it. And I didn't see it for probably about 10 years after that. And what's interesting to me is this is the movie for me that creates the demarcation of being limited to, you know, whatever, seven channels, and the advent of VCRs and being able to put on whatever you want, whenever you wanted. And by the time this came out, I had a local pub that I was hanging out in. And I remember they had the videotape and they put it on one night in the bar. And, you know, it was like a Tuesday night. It was nothing special, but there were probably maybe five of us in the bar. And we sat and we watched this thing and we were hysterical laughing through the whole movie. And that's been my take on it throughout. I've never seen this and thought it was anything but funny. But I know others think differently because of the subject matter sometimes. So we're going to get into a lot of stuff about that. But in the meanwhile, what are your first impressions, Sean?
Well, my background on this one's really interesting. I love Mel Brooks. So Young Frankenstein, Spaceballs, History of the World is probably one of my favorites of his. This one I've had an interesting relationship with. My first like viewings of it, and I put quotes around viewings, the film was on in the background. You know, like we were doing other things. There was a get together or something like that. And so I never really was watching it. We used to do these movie nights in the 90s. It was two other buddies of mine. We'd get together on a Sunday and just pick a random movie to watch. And we'd go to a local video store, grab a film, bring it back. This one was one of the ones that we did. I remember enjoying it. I just don't remember connecting with it and, you know, finding it really funny or anything like that. If you were to ask me, though, Sean, what was the movie about and all of that, I couldn't have really told you. I mean, I know the basic premise of the sheriff and things like that. This time around, I'm going to be honest, was really the first time I think I really watched it. And so my comments today are going to be really driven on the fact that beginning to the end, I watched this and really was captivated by it and have a lot I want to say. But that's been kind of my relationship with it. So strangely, I'm a newbie to it, even though I'm not. I mean, it's been there, you know, through most of my life. It's just a film that I've never really connected with before now. And I think it's an intriguing film to talk about. So a lot to say. So I'm holding some things back right now on purpose, but I figured they'll come out organically in the conversation.
What do you say, John?
Oh man, I was trying to think about this. This is one of those movies I like learned about before I saw. It's one of those where I had heard a lot of the lines beforehand. I had heard a lot of the scenes described. I know I saw some of it at some point when I was younger. I don't know if it was on TV or if it was on, someone had rented it at a VCR, probably that, because I distinctly remember my dad, who is not really known for, you know, his subtlety and the humor he appreciates, but I remember him during the bourbon and beans scene. I have never seen him laugh that hard in my life. And I have that as a memory being young, but other than that, I don't. As I've gotten older, I've watched it a bunch of times, but with Sean, I don't think I actually very often sat down and just watched it from beginning to end. Maggie and I know, have seen it three times now, once, twice for this, and we had seen it once before. And so that'll be interesting to talk about, because even though she's not here, she definitely wants me to pass on some of her impressions about it.
So I'm going to jump right into what I think is the meat of the conversation on this movie. When this comes up in conversation, now almost universally, somebody in the conversation will say, well, you couldn't get away with making this movie today. And that's the topic I want to discuss, because I'm going to narrow this down really fast, and I'm sure we'll get into more details as we go on. But a lot of the things that they say you can't talk about, you know, and most of it is, you know, the relationship of the white people to the black people. Most of it belittles the people who are racists. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's that bad in that regard, because the racist people are shown to be idiots, and the people who have the racism charges against them are clearly much smarter than the people who are making the charges. So I don't find it offensive in any way on that level, and I don't really see any problem with it. Now, I'm not a black person, so maybe somebody who is black might still feel differently about it. So I can't speak for others, just myself. The two things that I thought were possibly, you know, really offensive on some level to people who might have a problem with it is, I think there was very, very little portrayal of gay people, but that was not done in a sensitive way. Mm-hmm. So I could see where that might be offensive to some people. And then the other thing, and this is the one that I really had to think about, because I used to think it was funny, and now I find it to be just terribly insensitive. There are two jokes in there about rape. Mm-hmm. And I really, you know, at the time, I just thought, oh, you know, that's no big deal. Like, there's the one guy who says, you know, he's listing his crimes, says rape, this, rape. And they say, you said rape twice. I like rape. Mm-hmm. I thought that was funny when I was 20 years old and really didn't think about what it meant. But now I'm thinking, you could have really thrown some other crime in there that wasn't quite as just horrible as rape is. I mean, I would have been more comfortable with murder than I was with rape when I was watching it now. So that was the part that I thought, boy, if they were making this today, you'd have to change that line for certain. But like I said, most of the criticism that's brought against it as far as racism and all of that, I find it to be humorous, and I find it to be that they're showing the people to be uneducated and dumb, and that, you know, that makes it okay to show it that way because they're belittling the racism.
I think part of the brilliance of this is the fact that the idiots stay idiots through the entire film, like right through to the end. And the people that are racist don't become instantly enlightened by the end of the film. They're actually still doing it at the end of the movie, just to different groups. And they're being called out on it, and they still haven't quite gotten it. And I actually like the absurdity of the way that they handle racism. It's absurd. And the film constantly, that's the satire, right? It's the absurdity of it. And it owns it, and it's part of the messaging in the film. And I think that part is brilliant and really holds up. I agree with you. There's certain things that are dated. There's certain things that we know more about now, like the rape part. I'm with you. That was cringy then. I mean, it's cringy now. I don't know that when this film came out that I was really understanding, you know, what rape really means. I think there's been so much now that we as a culture, I think, understand what that really does to somebody psychologically. Now, you're right. There's certain jokes that just don't hold up because of the fact that we've evolved. But that's why I think some of the brilliance of this film is, this is the type of film you can watch and have a conversation around. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I think it's an important film because of the fact that there are things in it that are uncomfortable. The racism piece, I would be very curious to see the general consensus as far as whether or not that's offensive nowadays, because I found actually the absurdity of it being a nice smack to the face of just how dumb it is. And I thought that, I think that's the brilliance of it, in that at that time frame, Mel Brooks was putting out a movie that makes fun of it in the most inviting way. And I sound like I'm doing Mary Poppins, but in the most, yeah. But I really found that to be absolutely brilliant and charming about the film. The fact that it's talking about this really tough topic in a way that is, it makes us laugh at our culture in and of itself and just some of the dumb things that we do. And that's the brilliance of Mel Brooks's writing. I don't know why I didn't catch on to this film, you know, back in the day as I was watching it. I don't know if I just wasn't in the right mental headspace when I was watching this. But this time through, the brilliance of his tackling some tough topics in a way that I think only Mel Brooks can, And I think that's part of the piece when people are saying things like this film could not be made today. The question is, who are the writers that could make this type of film today? I think that's the piece that's the key. I think you can tackle topics like this. Would you make it exactly like Blazing Saddles was made? No, because to your point, Paul, there's some things that they talked about in this that, I don't know, today you would handle differently. You're right. That sequence might be, I like murder. I did murder twice or something else that was absurd. I think you would do different lines. But I think you're hitting on to something there. I don't know that it's really true that you couldn't do a film like this now. I'm trying to think of who the writers are that are doing this type of satire nowadays. I think the same thing can be said about Airplane. You know, you couldn't make Airplane now. I know we're doing a new Naked Gun. Until that comes out, do we have writers right now that are able to do that caliber of satire and that caliber of writing? I don't know, because I'm not seeing that kind of comedy out there now. And what Brooks put together with this is brilliant.
I think that there's an element of this where, yeah, no question, you can make satire of this at this level. I mean, this shows like South Park and things like that that do that. But my question, I think, more or less is, could you do this type of humor and have it be mainstream? Because I don't think South Park is really mainstream. Mm-hmm. I think that's a little bit more of a, off to the side for people with certain tastes. This movie, I think, was considered to be mainstream. In fact, I think it's number 6 on the AFI all-time comedy list.
Right.
Somewhere like that. And that's, not even all that long ago. So when you talk about, can we make it today? In very recent times, within, say, the last 10 years, this was considered to be one of the greatest comedies ever. So, I think you have to take that into account as well. John, I'm interested in your thoughts.
Oh, I think I have a few. Sean put two things that are very, very important about it that I think we should keep in mind for the entirety of this show whenever we're talking about this discussion. Number one is it's about both of you were talking about who is the butt of the joke is the very important thing. Where is the power flowing as it were? And the other one is the writer. The answer, what a lot of people don't know, and what we probably didn't even realize as much, is this movie was just as controversial in the day it came out. I mean, people were having very similar conversations than we're having right now about the appropriateness of it. So that's that. And also, there's a lot of movies that you couldn't make today for a variety of reasons. But what I think is really interesting about this one and the discussion that comes up around this one is that since I started podcasting, I have heard conversations go from this movie could not be made today. It actually goes a little too far and all this, and those words just they take away from the humor and the point from a universal level, to what is this woke garbage. That's where the conversation goes now. More people that are talking about it whenever it comes up are talking about the so-called woke aspects of it. So I think that's a pretty good sign for the movie as it's gone on to actually come around, and people are complaining at it because it's doing what it was intended to do. And there's always the old saw that if you manage to piss off both the left and the right with equal extremes, you probably are doing something right. But I want to sum this up once, because there's a lot to unpack with this. But Mel Brooks, I read his memoir recently. Well, at least right after we were planning to do this 5 years ago or something. What he talks about this like for a couple of pages, because he's aware of it, and he talks about, and he says there are definitely some jokes he wouldn't have done today. But what he reminds us, and I think what we're all getting at by talking around it, is comedy's about heart. It's not so much the subject matter, it's how the subject matter was done. It was the way it was presented. It's the absurdity, the ludicrousness, all of it put forward is there to do what it's intended to do. At that time, we didn't really have the concept of punching up that we hear about now, so that's where a lot of times people compare it to this. So I think if you're looking at it in a vacuum and not knowing what you're getting into, you might be like come across as a very different thing, like Maggie did when she first watched it. But as it goes on, paying attention to it, the real message comes across pretty well, I think.
Now, I know I can give this a little bit of a look through fresh eyes because I watched it. I did not need to rewatch this. I've seen it so many times, but I watched it the other night for the sake of just having it fresh in my mind. And my wife surprised me by saying she had never seen it before. And she wasn't really paying close attention to it. So I can't, you know, give her total credit for her outrage. But just kind of glancing up every once in a while from what she was doing and catching some of the off-color humor, her thought was, oh, that's terrible. Why would they do that? You know, so if you're not looking at this closely, I think you don't see the aspect of them punching up. I think you don't see that, you know, that they're actually making fun of the concepts of the racism. And therefore, it could be offensive. If you're looking at it on a very superficial level, which is what she was, you know, she really wasn't watching it. She was just hanging out while I was watching it. But she caught things on a superficial level and found it to be bothersome. Mm-hmm. You know, so I guess, you know, you need to look a little closer to really get a good feel for what this movie is doing. And when you do, first of all, there's the aspect of no one is safe. We're going to make fun of everybody. So if we make fun of everybody, nobody should feel like they're being singled out. Mm-hmm. And second of all, they were making fun of the absurdity of a lot of these concepts. And when they didn't, that's when we're calling them out. When they didn't, you know, when they didn't make rape sound like a horrible thing, that's why that's offensive, because they didn't make it sound like a horrible thing. You know, you got to also take into account the time it was made. You know, I mentioned that, you know, that I would imagine the gay community finds the stereotypes shown in the movie, which weren't, you know, weren't overwhelming, but there were enough of them where they would find that probably to be offensive, and I don't blame them.
One of my gay friends, who doesn't speak for all of them, I'm sure, thinks that the Dom DeLuise bit is one of the funniest scenes he has ever seen in a movie.
It really comes down to a matter of, do you want to look at the humor or do you want to be sensitive? Mm-hmm. And usually I'm falling on the I want to look at the humor side. I am not the most woke person in the world, and I joke around often about that. You know, as an Italian American, I'm going to sue Nintendo for the stereotype of Mario from Mario Brothers.
Right.
You know. And I find Mario to be funny when he talks with his Italian accent and does things, but you know, but other people I could see where if you want to take the offense to a far level, you could be bothered by that.
Well, if I can, sorry, Paul, if I can,
no, go ahead.
From the so-called woke contingent, I guess I would sort of follow along those lines. I can say that I would say, and a lot of us I think would agree, that one of our problems on this side of the aisle, who in our desire to try to bring attention to these issues, we have made it into kind of a parody of itself. This happened in the 90s too, with when the political correctness, as it was, started to get a little too much. I think we've spent too much time worrying about movies that were out 50 years ago and whether or not they were offensive than paying, and I think that got us distracted because we spent way too much time doing that when ultimately, what is that saying? So that's something we should all think about. The other thing that's really important is that it's because of this movie that we're actually having conversations along the lines that we are. This movie is famous for what it did and for how it was really addressing these. And if it hadn't had that clarity, that heart, that intention, I don't think we'd be talking about this movie as one of the best ones of all time.
I totally agree with you. And, you know, again, setting aside other stereotypes and whatever might go on, the true heart of this movie, the true message is that racism is foolish. I mean, that's the message that comes through loud and clear. And the main character, Sheriff Bart, played by Cleavon Little, is by far the coolest character in the movie. You know, you walk away from the movie, that's the one you want to be. Mm-hmm. So I certainly don't think that anybody should be offended by him or his portrayal. It's interesting because that was originally supposed to be Richard Pryor, and I can't imagine Pryor doing it even as well as Cleavon Little did. He was so perfect for this part. Mm-hmm. Now, Richard Pryor had, you know, he was in the writer's room on this movie. He was, you know, he participated a lot. But I believe, at least the way I understand it, is the producers felt, because of his history with drug use and all of that, he was just too much of a wild card, and they wouldn't green light him starring in it.
Right.
And they eventually got to Cleavon Little, who I don't think you could have a more perfect casting, to be honest.
Here's where I'm really glad about that. I actually really love Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder together. I'm a fan of their films. I'm a fan of the partnership and the way that they play off each other. In most cases, I think there's been some real brilliance there. This film should not be lumped into another Gene Wilder, Richard Pryor vehicle, because it's different. And that's no insult to Richard Pryor in any way, shape, or form. I'm afraid if he had been in this one, that I think what works about this film would have been lost. Cleavon Little, I think right from the beginning, it's what's really important is, and Richard Pryor is this, he's very likable. Like right from the get-go, there's something engaging and likable about him. And you need to ride along with him because of everything that's going on with this film and the absurdity. If he's not likable, you're not like on his side saying everybody else is an idiot. That's the magic of this film is, he's likable. He's our guy. I want to be on a horse riding along with him. When Gene Wilder gets involved with them, I still want to hang with, those are my guys. Mm-hmm. And that's with a comedy that's really critical, that with all the satire that's going on around you, even Paul, you mentioned the rape part where they're sending the worst criminals on the planet after this town. So when you go through that motley crew that's going along, that whole crew, as it goes further along, yeah, that group gets more absurd because they're pulling people from around the world and out of time and plopping them into the worst criminals. So that sequence is meant to be a satire on like just the obsessive violence and self-interest of our lead, Harvey Korman. To me, Cleavon Little was brilliant casting because of the fact that I liked him. I really liked him as a character. And I think that if you don't nail that in this film, a lot of the humor beats get lost. I don't know why I didn't catch on to this the first times that I watched it. And I do think it has to do with distraction. It was a background film. I think this was the first time I actually sat down and it had my attention. And I think this is a film that demands that in order to really get what's going on here. And because I think there's just so much going on. There's a lot going on in this film.
I'm going to throw an interesting concept out at you from the Wikipedia page. It said that the original thought, the first thought on this was that the sheriff was going to be played by James Earl Jones.
Yep.
That's just like, I can't even picture this movie with him as in the lead. And you know, and I got to struggle a little bit to think of James Earl Jones circa 1974, as opposed to the James Earl Jones who was much more visible on the screen in, say, Field of Dreams. Mm-hmm. But just even that younger James Earl Jones, I don't see him doing what Cleavon Little did. And I'm not seeing it at all.
Cisco Kid was offered to, John Wayne, who said it was too blue, but thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever read. So,
yeah, I read that. He said he isn't going to do it, but he'll be first online to come and see it when it's made.
Yeah.
I like what Sean was saying there about it. Just the likability of him. I wish I could see once the alternate universe version where Richard Pryor did star as him, because it would be a completely different, it would be a different tone in the same way, which would be interesting, because I'm with you, Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor together, a level of genius you didn't get to often in Stir Crazy and See No Evil, Hear No Evil, for example. But this, I think Bart is so effective. He does it in his face constantly, because he's, of all of the characters, he's the most genre aware. He's the most aware that he's in a movie than any of them, which becomes important hilarious for the ending, but it's because of that. It's because he doesn't mug to the camera all that much, but basically, you know what he's thinking. he can say so much with a look of up here we go, here we go again, and all of that stuff, and just the blank look on his face after he gets, you know, rejected, and Gene's trying to console him in what I think is the funniest scene in the whole movie.
Well, I do find that from, you know, the more I've critiqued comedies, the more I've realized that comic acting is far, far more effective when they treat it as if it's dramatic acting.
Yes.
You know, the second they start mugging for the camera or you know, waiting for the applause or the laugh, it really just loses all effectiveness, unless they're doing 99% serious and then they just throw that one moment in there to break the fourth wall or whatever. And I think Cleavon Little kind of does that in this movie, and perfectly so. I think that's really what works. And it's something I've leaned on for a long time, but I hadn't really thought about it, is, you know, there were times where I'd be laughing at something in a movie and somebody would say, well, that's not funny. And I'd say, it's not the line that's funny, it's the way it's said.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key very often to comedy. You know, you put different actors in the role and it's going to be different. Now, Richard Pryor was a comic genius. I don't, you know, argue that for a second. But he also had a little bit more of an edge to him. He had a lot more of an edge to him than Cleavon Little did. So I don't know if that character is as effective if he's edgy. I think the fact that he's willing to just kind of roll with the punches and to make himself fit in, you know, that's what works in this movie. And then you add to it the scene, which I think gives him some heart, when the old lady curses at him and he's upset afterwards. It, you know, you're giving him a little depth. You're keeping him from being just a cardboard character because he got upset by it. And then, you know, Gene Wilder has to say, hey, what did you expect? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that I think adds to this film. And I think it adds to the heart of the movie. So I think his character, as Sean said, is critical to this movie. And I think his casting is critical to this movie. I don't think this movie, as much of a comic genius as Richard Pryor was, I don't think this movie would be as fondly remembered if he had played the lead.
I agree with you. And that, you know, morons line, either Gene Wilder ad-libbed it or Mel told him to say it without telling him that it was going to be said. When he breaks into laughter, that was genuine. Just if you watch the scene knowing that, you can tell. It's just the way that you can tell a genuine, you know, versus a very loud. He had that just brief glint in the, I'm an actor again. That's funny. And now I'm curious. It was.
Now, you know, we talked about the casting. The other interesting thing is that, you know, you mentioned John Wayne being cast as the kid. Gig Young, who's not really well known today, but back then was pretty well known, was originally cast, and they actually started filming, and Gig Young historically had an alcohol issue and apparently passed out on the set after the first scene was filmed, and they replaced him with Gene Wilder. So to me, that was definitely a level of luck there too, because Gene Wilder is also pretty much perfect in his role. And Gig Young, I think I could point to him from, he was in the movie They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Yeah.
And he was, for me, the most thing that I remember with him is he was in an episode of The Twilight Zone called Walking Distance. And he was, you know, he strikes me always as a serious actor. I don't see him as a comedic actor. Now, that may have played well, but I think they were better off with the way they went. I think, you know, Having Gene Wilder, I think, was again a little bit of fortuitous casting.
Gene Wilder, where he works in this so much, Gene Wilder, I've always felt, is he's got kind eyes. Mm-hmm. Like there's something about Gene where you immediately feel comforted, like seeing him when he's on the screen. But he also pulled this off too, which you don't see very often with Gene Wilder. He was cool. Like,
yeah.
Like the sequence where they're at the chessboard, and like we know we've seen the shaky hand, sure. And that he was, I mean, there's a mystery behind this character. But when he pulled, like, he's like, go ahead and, you know, put your clasp your hands around it. You know, go ahead and clasp your hands around and you grab it first. And Cleavon Little's like, there's no, I mean, like, this is a joke. There's no way I'm not going to grab it. We all knew what was going to happen, right? I mean, the setup was there. I mean, it was the carpet was rolled out for us, but the execution and the acting of that sequence between the two actors that were playing off each other was so brilliantly played. It set the stage for any time he was on the screen with Cleavon Little, you knew it doesn't matter how many people are there. This guy's going to do something cool. And that tone for head character throughout the rest of the film, this was a comedy that like had such insane balance on it. There were sequences of this where they were some of the coolest scenes that I'd seen in a film in a while. And they hold up today. Mm-hmm. And there was something about the mystique of that character that's not something you always see from Gene Wilder, because he's usually the victim in a lot of his films. Mm. You know, where, you know, he's the good guy who has things happening to him. In this case, he was the cool character, the badass character that you want with you. And it worked, yet he still had all of the same Gene Wilder charm that fits in every one of his roles. That balance, it was something I think real different than I'm used to seeing with Gene Wilder. And it really stood out in this as being something that I'm like, man, he showed some range without losing that kind of, I really like this character. And it, to me, it made them, again, I want to ride with, I don't care who you're putting as against, I'm riding with these two guys. And that was something that I think was critical for this film. The casting was really strong for our leads.
I think, then, but really... even throwing in some of the smaller roles, like, you know, Slim Pickens, yes. You know, certainly played well with, you know, what we were trying, the feel they were trying to get. I mean, Slim Pickens is almost, he's one of those guys that just kind of fits the, you know, American Western movie stereotype. I mm-hmm. hate to use stereotype because it's got a negative connotation, but he's almost like a you know, just a piece of furniture in a Western movie. You need him there. Mm-hmm. So characters like him, the actor who played Lyle, the only other thing I can remember seeing him in was the Back to the Future Part 3, where he's kind of almost playing the same role, but in a small part. Yeah, but he fit it really well. There was kind of a hierarchy of stupidity with these people. And we start off meeting Lyle, and he shows himself to be an idiot. Then Slim Pickens comes over, and he's telling them, you know, don't do this, blah, blah. So you're thinking, oh, he's a little smarter. And then he shows himself to be an idiot. And then Harvey Korman takes over for him, and then he shows himself to be an idiot. And then Governor LePetame, the same thing. I mean, it's just every level. It's almost like the what is it? The I can't even think of it. The theory where you rise to your level of stupidity.
Oh, Peter Principle.
Peter Principle. I couldn't think of the word. It's almost like that in play, the way that they do this thing. And I just think it's terrific. There's never a point where you think, okay, this guy is not only the bad guy, but you could see he's smart and he's doing things. No, they're all idiots.
you the two of you, I think, really in what you just said have hit the head on what makes this kind of satire or parody work or not work. And the main thing is, it's a in parts, it's a decent example of the genre is parodying, because the circling the wagon scene with the Mel Brooks in red face bit. The other bit, this might be a little bit too far, but that is right out of High Noon, or out of what is it, Stagecoach? Yes. It is a John Ford direction. It is done as a, if you go back and watch Stagecoach, that scene is basic. It is doing a direct send up of a very famous scene in the movie. It's like Galaxy Quest or Tropic Thunder, any of those where the movie itself is entertaining from beginning to end. You know, there's all the wacky stuff, but the plot is engaging enough. You kind of want to see how he's going to get out of this. And you're on the side of Bart and the kid. So it's a really good one. And that aspect, I think, allows the important parts of the humor to really go through because of the authenticity. I think that aspect lends to it.
Agreed. And but you know, some of the humor comes from just the absurdity of the situations and then the anachronistic things that just occur, which you know, they take to the nth level. And what I thought of while I was watching it this time that I hadn't thought of before is Airplane is looked at as being, you know, this groundbreaking movie just because of the level of silliness of what it does. And then as I was watching this, I was thinking, you know what? The Zucker brothers probably were inspired a little bit by this movie because there's a very, very similar humor in a lot of this.
In two ways. The actors in both movies before this were entirely known for serious roles, and they didn't really do anything different than their typical stereotypical way that they deliver their lines, but the lines were funny. Leslie Nielsen is the biggest example of this. Before Airplane, he was known for serious roles, usually bad guys, and has exactly that same delivery. But when he's delivering things like, "I am serious and don't call me Shirley," then it's funny. And this has the same thing. Slim Pickens is playing as, yes, he's an idiot, but he's playing a Slim Pickens cowboy. The other staples from Westerns are playing staples. Higgins from Magnum PI. I know that he gets around Hawaii a lot on that show, but I didn't know he went time traveling and was a bit of a closet racist. But there he is, you know.
And that there's some minor things that I just, you know, you find amusing is just, you know, everybody in the town is named Johnson. You know, you have Howard Johnson and Gabby Johnson. I always found Gabby Johnson to be particularly funny, you know, when he just yells something out and then David Huddleston says, "I'm glad these kids were here to hear that." Not only is it an example of true frontier gibberish, but it expresses a thought rarely heard. I just found it to be hilarious.
Oh yeah, God. He what's the name of that guy? The guy that was at the head of that? He's been in, I think, every single Western before he
David
was alive.
Huddleston.
Yeah. And afterwards. He was in Little House on the Prairie, I know.
He played, I don't know why, but for some reason he stands out in my mind that he played Santa Claus in Santa Claus the movie.
Oh, that's him. Oh yeah.
Yes.
I'll have to go watch that.
I think the Airplane comparison is really strong because I think you're right. I absolutely think that the Zucker brothers and Abrams took elements of the or had to be influenced on some level from this because Robert Stack's character, I think, in Airplane is a great, which is the first person they sought out. He's so totally traditional Robert Stack through the whole thing, and that's the brilliance. The absurdity going around him, he is staying the straight man. It's almost like none of that's going on around him, and this is a very normal situation. And I think the brilliance of Blazing Saddles is when you've got strong actors that are not reacting like anything is odd going on around them, but we're seeing the absurdity of everything going on around them.
And
And that's
that's taken to the extreme by the end.
Yes. Oh, very,
No.
very, very much so. And that's because that's the part where I think it works. They're afraid, like, hey, this movie's been crazy, so let's just go
Not only does it break the fourth wall, it breaks the fifth wall in a way that I don't think any movie this side of Monty Python and the Holy Grail has ever ended a movie that way. Because
Yes.
it is brilliant and also really kind of puts a bow on what we're doing here. The helicopter or the crane shot of that Western scene being pulled up over the Hollywood lot is very special to me, especially since that scene is in almost every Western you've ever, that set of that town is in almost every Western you have ever seen. It is in High Noon. It is in just every several different John Wayne ones. And it's just so in order to really, really pull out and remind you, this is a movie. And these are, and we've got to remember Westerns at the time, it was, they were on a downslide then. But before then, Westerns were a level of popularity we're not really familiar with today. We think there's too many superheroes movies. They were cranking out 20 or 30 Westerns a month.
Yes.
The reason that John Wayne is so famous, he had basically a lifetime contract and just did that character over and over again. You would see that thing. This is, and also, if I can just quickly, I don't want to belabor this too much, but it's also a satire of the Old West itself and the sanitized version of it that we, you know, have in our heads, both in the movies and in the real life, about it likes to erase the experiences of the non-white folks, which is how a lot of history works. But in this case, for example, the word cowboy is cowboy because ranch hands at first were primarily black people. Boy is a derogatory term they would use and still do use. So they became cowboys, but because of how they were able to establish themselves, how it became such a staple part of the society, it just became the broader term. For example, it was one of the time, I don't think there is a single time in the history of this country where actually black people and women, for that matter, had more opportunities and more actual freedoms because they were in territories rather than, you know, dealing with the country itself, and were able to get away with this. You did have black sheriffs, you did have black marshals, you had a couple of black mayors, things like that. We don't know that because of how, you know, usually sanitized it is. So by doing a movie that shines a spotlight on that, he shines a spotlight on the greater thing. And here we are 50 years later having a discussion about it. So
one piece I want to make sure we don't forget in this, because we just talked about how insane it gets. This is, again, the brilliance of Mel Brooks and the writing of this film. He didn't forget that there's an overarching story here that still needs to wrap up.
Yeah.
So he dropped a bomb and we went to the craziest possible places that you can go, but he still wrapped up the fact that we still want to see Bart get Hedley Lamarr.
Yeah.
The brilliance of Harvey Korman in this one is we've given him, yes, he's insane and he's got all those pieces, but he had an intense amount of money, an intense amount of power, and he was evil. And by the end of this film, we wanted to see Bart get the bad guy. Yeah. They took it. We went in movie theaters where they wanted to see the ending and all that kind of stuff. But yet we still got the sequence where he went and got Hedley Lamarr.
Yep.
And I think that's something you could have in the crate, gotten lost in the crazy and never tightened everything up. This does wrap up with a really nice, neat bow.
Right, better than even Holy Grail does.
We blew everything
and then they get off the horses and get into a limousine.
Which was great. Which was so great. But because there was such a satisfying ending prior to that, that epilogue sequence was awesome. I mean, it was everything you wanted to see in this film that you didn't know that you wanted.
Yeah, absolutely. The history is that this script was worked on and worked on and worked on. And clearly they managed to make a very tight script that appears to be very loose. And I think that is part of the brilliance of it, because they knew exactly where they were going, but it feels like it's just scattershot, that they're all over the place. And I give Mel Brooks credit that somehow he even managed to make fun of Hitler in this movie. You know, I'm out after the bunker scene. I just think that that's a great little throwaway line and throwaway scene that they have that in there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and that's where he was going with too in his autobiography. He's quoting from, C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters, is that don't try to fight evil on its own terms. If you really want to get under evil's skin, make fun of them. Make them into the stupidity, point out how stupid and silly these things that they believe are, and that's how you get them, because they can't handle that. We've seen that in life. A lot of people that supposedly are very strong and whatnot, if you get the exact right zinger on them, they don't know what to do. It's because their entire, this level of racism that this movie does such a brilliant job of pointing out, is it, in order to work, it requires the participation of pretty much, you know, everybody involved. Let me say that again, because this sort of racism requires there to be an understood power level by the people that are being racist to the people that are not. Now, that power, it's like most power, is an illusion, but through just reuse and redoing it, it gets into our system and we do it without even thinking about it. And it's only when you take the time to unpack it and put it down and lay it all down the best you can that the absurdity comes out of it. It's absurd to judge another person because of the way that they look, because of the color of their skin, because of their religion, any of those things. We all know it's absurd, but stereotypes are stereotypes. History is history, and we do that. And movies like this, I think, Get Out. Some people in the future will probably put both of them in the same category, not because of comedies, but because of the subject matter they managed to tackle in a way that they managed to take it. And everybody walked out of it knowing and thinking more about racism than they had before going into it.
Comedy is such a great vehicle for tough topics because of the fact that when you sit there and you laugh at you know, the idiots in the film, how do you walk out of the film and then go, I want to be that? I mean, it's when you're talking about these topics, I think it's sometimes an important way to introduce sometimes these topics that in a serious conversation, we're sometimes afraid to open up and start discussing. I think a film like this is a great way to introduce it afterwards, where you're like, we just spent a whole bunch of time looking at this group of people as morons. I don't know. Maybe there's something to learn there. And that's the brilliance. I think that's the brilliance of a film like this being a introductory piece to maybe we should talk about all this. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. And I do think comedy is one of the best ways to attack the silliness of some social norms. And I think that's kind of the mission statement of this movie. So did you know, I guess we're going to go into our regular film discussion and say, you know, what about the score? I guess we're kind of looking combination score and soundtrack, because you got the opening song, the lyrics of which were written by Mel Brooks. But you know, it's got that traditional old Western sound to it. And, you know, then you have Count Basie appearing in the movie with the orchestra.
I don't know why, but that gets me every single time where suddenly, and it's Count Basie. I don't know why.
He did something similar in High Anxiety, which we'll probably get to eventually. Oh, yeah. With the orchestra on the bus. I thought the music in this was perfect. I thought it really just kind of emphasized everything. It gave you the feeling of those Westerns. And, you know, except if you're too sensitive, I think almost everything about this movie is perfect, to be honest with you.
Atmosphere. When I think of the soundtrack of this film, there's sometimes talent when they understand how to put a film together. They understand the importance of atmosphere. This film, you think about all the set pieces that were in this film. If you did not have the right music throughout this film, I think you would have lost something in the set pieces. A lot of times it transported you to where they were at, when sometimes the set pieces were designed to be a fourth and fifth wall breaking. The music was sometimes letting you know, this is where we are at right now. It was such a partner to the acting and to the actual set pieces that were built there. There's films that don't get this right. I agree with you, Paul. This is an area where, again, I don't know, what would you change on the soundtrack to this thing? I think they did a great job of partnering that up in such a way that it set the stage.
According to Wikipedia, once again, it said, you know, when they were getting ready to do this, Mel Brooks advertised in the trade papers that he was looking for a singer like Frankie Lane to sing the lead song. Was shocked when Frankie Lane actually said, yeah, I'll do it.
And he didn't tell him it was a comedy because he was afraid. Once he got it, because he was afraid he'd leave.
We got lucky with his serious interpretation of the song.
Indeed.
So just great stuff. With a couple of minor speed bumps, like the rape comments, I don't think there's anything I would change about this movie. I really don't. I don't think it's aged badly in any way. I think the message is still strong of the stupidity of what goes on in the world. And I absolutely rank it as a Jaws. No question in my mind.
Yeah, this is a Jaws with a bullet. I mean, this, you could call this show "Is It Blazing Saddles" if you wanted to, in terms of, but yes, this movie embodies what you mean by Jaws when you say it. It's, and especially in the ways you said, and just to bring it back, this movie was, you know, as probably as controversial, if not more, in a couple of ways when it came out. People were having very similar discussions about the appropriateness of a lot of that humor and various things. So
why it was rated R.
Exactly. You don't get too many movies rated R for language. And this would be mostly language is the issue.
Yeah, there's no sexual content to speak of except for those throwaway lines.
Oh, and
there's
Madeline Kahn.
All of the violence. Oh yeah, that's true. There's a little there, but a young kid wouldn't get that anyway. It'd be totally right over their head. And the violence is all very, very cartoony. So, you know, in fact, they even make fun of like the Warner Brothers cartoons with one piece of violence against Mongol. Yeah. So, you know, there is no reason for this to be rated R other than if they think the subject matter is too sensitive.
It's definitely a Jaws. And I think, It's almost like a Jaws plus. And where the plus comes from for me is I took a film class in high school. And one of the things that the film, we started right from the beginning of film and kind of worked our way straight on through. We saw films that were dated, that had dated concepts that were like trapped in kind of their era. But they led to conversation. This is a film that it's okay. If you watch this film and you're offended by something in the film, it's okay.
You should be.
It starts conversation. And this is a film that I think starts important conversation. And I think there were things in our conversation, like Paul, you mentioned the whole thing with the rape sequence where that was brought in. You know, it was a small sequence. And by the way, let's be very clear. These were the worst of the worst criminals that they were seeking out who were throwing out that line. But I think there's something to say, why did that upset you? Let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. I think this is that kind of film. Because it's meant to fly in the face of what is evil, what is wrong, what is stereotypical, what is racist. And I think for a film to do that in a inviting way to open up those conversations, I think it's an important movie. I'm so glad that we did this because of the fact that, like I said, this was kind of my first viewing in the sense, even though this film's been around so long, I remember as a kid, the trailer where Mongo punches the horse, because that was vividly in the trailer, and it's something that stood out for me. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that sequence. And I remember laughing at that as a kid. I don't remember, I don't know why I haven't like really actually watched this film in the way that I did before now. But I think this is definitely a film that should be on the list, and you shouldn't shy away from it because of the subject matter. If anything, watch it with people. And talk to people about it afterwards, because I think that to me is the bang for the buck. This, I was looking forward to this conversation because I knew this was going to be a fun one because there's something to talk about.
I was really glad it was with the two of you because, you know, this conversation, that I knew that we would just dive right into it. There'd be too many people that would try to tap dance around the edges, but I really, really enjoyed this conversation with the both of you as always.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I did as well, John. And I'm glad you were available to do it. I'm sorry Maggie wasn't, because she would have given us a fourth perspective on this, I believe, especially as somebody, you know, younger than us who probably experienced this at a different time in a different way of, you know, when life was a little different. So it would have just been interesting to hear her take on it, but we'll get her around next time that you come on. That's all.
Maggie, just pawn in Game of Life.
Which was, Mel Brooks said specifically, a Richard Pryor line.
That he thought was
brilliant. The other thing I just want to throw in when you talk about movies being offensive or whatever, I think you have to keep in mind sometimes when a movie was made and the perception of reality at the time it was made. And I think that's something that people lose when we, you know, when they talk about, you know, oh, this is offensive, that's offensive. Sometimes people's awareness becomes greater as time goes on. Certain things that were not considered bad, you know, as more thought was given to them and more consideration to people, they realize, you know what, that's really not so cool. Don't do that. But that doesn't mean that when it was made, that was the prevailing thought process. And I think sometimes you have to keep that in mind. I don't even think this movie in particular has that feeling, but I think there are some movies that are kind of blacklisted now because of the content that was in there, which was acceptable at the time, and it's no longer acceptable. I almost feel like you're better off if you just look at it with an eye towards that. And I know there were some, I think it was some cartoons of like the 40s or 30s that were released that had some racial insensitivity to them. And I think, if I remember right, I think they had Whoopi Goldberg do an introduction where she said, view these as an element of the time. And I could be wrong on that. Maybe it was somebody else.
That it was her. They did that. And I thought it was a really good thing. Some people complained even that they shouldn't have even had to do that. But I thought that's a really good compromise. Because, I mean, comedy, especially. Comedy is made for the era it's in, for the audience. And especially comedy like this that's making social commentary about the modern day. It's going to. Things are not going to hold up. But that shouldn't be the focus. That shouldn't be the first thing we look at. That should be definitely a part of the conversation which we had here. But the first thing we want to look at is intent and heart, I think. And what we got out of here is both the intent and the heart were definitely in the right place for this movie.
Totally agreed. And I hope our listeners agree. And if anybody doesn't, I'd love to hear from you. You know, we have the Is It Yours Facebook page. And if you're not on that, you know, please feel free to join. There are some questions that are asked, and if you don't answer the questions, I will not accept you into the group because I'm afraid of spammers and different things. But if you answer the questions, which are very simple, it's like your favorite movie or whatever. If you answer the questions, I will gladly accept you into the group, and I would love to hear comments from people. Also, I'd love it if whatever podcast catcher you use, if you'd go on and give us the maximum number of stars, because we work hard to try and make everybody happy, including ourselves. So, you know, the more people that get to listen to us, the more we'll enjoy what we do. So, you know, we'd appreciate that. But thank you all for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks when we check out some other movie. Bye-bye.
Bye.
What did you expect? Welcome, Sonny. Make yourself at home. Marry my daughter. You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land, the common clay of the New West. You know, morons.